welcome to LHP. Joining me from the other side of a very thin-walled apartment, Eric Sayor.
Look, if you were trying to call me and not get noticed, I would simply just leave, not hang up the phone, leave it on so so you can't call me again.
Fantastic.
This is the only part of this movie where I'm like, why did you do that?
Yeah. Perfect. There are certain things about the old school phone era that are really simple, and and you look at movie characters from that era and you're like, why didn't you figure this out? Why are you, smart person who has told us you've done many heists, not able to figure this out? We're talking about Bound today, the 1996 Wazowski. I'm not going to pronounce that name.
You said their name like they're Mike Wazowski in Monsters,
Inc. You know what? Same thing. The same exact thing. I just imagine them like that. Anyway, we've talked about these directors before, of course. We did a large Matrix series sort of in like the middle of our entire run. Feels like it was a long time ago now.
Yes.
Feels like that was forever ago now. And we're going back to maybe not the first film, but like the film that is talked about as like the beginning of these directors. And it's mythologized. I might have brought this up during the Matrix podcast. It was talked about that like these directors were so considered so smart and like ahead of the game by the producers of the Matrix that they just let them do whatever they wanted, which allowed them to essentially rip off the comic book The Invisibles to make the Matrix, which is not an angry statement by me. It's just a thing that like people I know in comic book circles say a lot. And I can't say that they're wrong because I haven't actually read The Invisibles.
I'll say I've never heard about The Invisibles, but the thing that's really evident quickly in this movie is that a lot of their style is already there. A lot of their ideas are already there, and this is like at least in this, a lot of the stylistic nature of the and the camera movement, this feels like a test run for the Matrix.
It does. I mean, there's one shot in here where I was like, that's just the shot from the Matrix. It's just a practice. The shot following the phone line, I'm like, oh, I've seen that before. But I loved every moment of it. So I do want to sort of start there. The stylistic part of this movie is what's most interesting to me because it's not anything that's super advanced. It's just very competent. And I think that stylistic ability and that like understanding of craft, that has never ended. I think that's been always consistent. And that made this movie infinitely watchable. And it's just very easy to, you know, find things to pay attention to. And like, even if there are moments where you're like, okay, well, I've seen this scene before. They're just doing like Double Indemnity for most of the plot of this. you still find things and games within like the construction of the shooting of the movie to keep you interested. It's very pre Rian Johnson style stuff. I think that's the closest comparison that I can think of stylistically and like the control of that style. And the craft and all that. And it's
it's really post Tarantino, right? It's like a very, very like a Reservoir Dogs had 1,000 clones, and then you get Pulp Fiction, that's the big success, and everyone's like, here's money to make your own Reservoir Dogs or your own Pulp Fiction or whatever. And this movie really, really feels like that.
And to that point, there were a lot of those at the time. There were so many of those. We haven't covered a lot of them because many of those movies haven't aged very well. I would say that this movie has aged extremely well for an era full of these like Tarantino knockoffs that happened. This movie just plays. We were talking during the episode we recorded before this one, Possession, about how much we would like to see it in a theater. You in particular, I would love to see this in a theater. I don't know why this doesn't. I mean, maybe it does in other parts of the country, but I don't feel like it has a lot of theatrical re-release attention around it, and it should, because it absolutely, I feel like it would slap.
Yeah, I don't disagree. That's definitely would be a fun movie to watch in a series of Wachowski's retrospective.
Yeah.
I'd watch most of those movies in theaters.
Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. I kind of already gave away the plot because it is. So you've seen Double Indemnity?
Yes.
Okay. I just want to make sure when I say that it's Double Indemnity up until a point. And I'm presuming most people either have seen Double Indemnity, or if I told you the plot, you'd be like, oh, I know. Okay. It's a very basic plot line. Man seduced by a woman, and she's like playing him the whole time. This movie kind of starts there, and it's going off of your assumption that it's Double Indemnity. And then there's a very clear turning point where it's absolutely not Double Indemnity. Where it's, again, it's manipulating you into thinking it's going there. And it becomes a slightly more interesting thriller with a lot of people and a lot of tension. And the way that the sort of final act of this movie sort of builds on itself is extremely thrilling. I can see why Joey Pants is immediately in their next movie, because he is doing a lot in the last act of this movie to earn his place. But I guess, do you want to break down the plot any more, or do you just want to go off of the assumption
I think we can talk about the plot of this movie, because it's it does have this Double Indemnity vibe, but it's really I think it functions really well by the plot itself is most of the movie, right? And we can talk about the fun stuff while we go through it. The movie stars Jennifer Tilly and Gina Gershon, I think is how you pronounce her name. Gina Gershon is quirky, Nexcon. That's the most the most lesbian character ever put on the screen, maybe.
Yes,
She's every 90s lesbian cliche put together in one. She has an old truck that she works on. She has this excellent shit eating grin that she uses really, really well. Every shot of her face is incredible. And Jennifer Tilly plays the most femme fatale. Yep. Both to the extremes of those stereotypes.
Right. To the point where I wouldn't be surprised if there are many cracked style articles about how this is a Matrix prequel or a side story, because these characters do feel so straight out of a lookbook of a femme fatale and, hero, former crime character. Very, very archetypal. But what makes them interesting is the performances from both actresses are incredible and very layered. Jennifer Tilly has that Jessica Rabbit I'm just drawn that way thing about her. And yeah, it's just, and their entire vibe that they have with each other is just extremely watchable. Yeah.
Yeah, so you're kind of introduced to them. Corky's works in this apartment building where she's kind of renovating an apartment, fixing the tub, like doing the plumbing. And Corky, and then Violet, Jennifer Tilly is with this man. They live next door. And they, and it starts with this long look they have in the elevator that goes on and on and on. And it's there's like tension immediately. And I think this movie and uses the actors. I mean, there's so much in the eyes in that scene and throughout the movie. And the camera is really good at portraying that. And I mean, a lot of the camera moves going from like side to overhead and back. I mean, maybe we should mention the cinematographer of this movie is Bill Pope, who had worked at this point on a lot of Sam Raimi movies, and then later worked on some, the Spider-Man movies, has worked with Edgar Wright, is still like shooting blockbusters at this point.
Worked on all the Sonnenfelds and lots of Favreau stuff. Important guy.
yes, but like one of the movie's priorities is like Army of the Dead, and it's like, oh yeah, that makes sense that this guy shot this movie. I feel like he has the camera know-how to apply whatever the Wachowskis are trying to do here. So you get the, she gets the call from the actual owner of the building that's like, oh, go help your neighbor. They need someone. And it's Violet that dropped her earring in the sink on purpose so that Corky comes and gets it. And they really have this like... Violet is clearly trying to seduce Corky. I think she says it literally. Maybe I am trying to seduce you. And then her boyfriend, I guess that's the qualifier here that I use. The boyfriend, which is her also, I mean, he's Caesar, played by Joe Pantoliano, Joe Pants, how you call it before? Is that the way that people refer to him as?
I mean, I've referred to him as Joey Pants for as long as I can remember. That's just his name.
Okay. Pants plays Caesar, who's works for the mob. He's a money launderer. He is definitely not Italian, but really wants to be.
And again, very much like archetypal mob character, like very, again, like just straight out of like Goodfellas, like a guy in the background.
I try to say is that the thing about him is that he's not in the family. He just works for them, and he really wish he was. That's the part that's like kind of defines a lot of his relationship with the mafia. Caesar arrives and he's like, he really in a full on I'm a mafioso guy. He gives her like a few hundred dollars and is like, if you know what we're doing here, you know where to keep your mouth shut and all that. You'll take the money and you'll go. If you don't take it, I know I can't. I'll think I can't trust you. I think this is when she goes to the lesbian bar, which is a very funny scene because it's like it's like very normal. 90s lesbians, and she walks in and she's like, she's like the caricature of it. Like, she's like a lesbian James Dean.
Sorry, yep. I had to pick up a package real quick. yes, lesbian James Dean is a very good way to put that. Very, very succinct way of putting that. And that bar, from what I know, is apparently extremely accurate.
The thing about this movie is that we'll get to it, but I think kind of immediately after they basically have sex. And it's like a very, very intense, well done sex scene. Because they hired a lesbian consultant, a sex scene consultant, Susie Bright. And she helped them shoot that and set that up. I mean, that whole scene is done in one shot. I think they had the thing they say about it is that had, like, I think a couple of versions, and like one was the one the studio wanted. The studio didn't want to do because it was too much. And they ended up with this scene, which is also kind of it's a lot, but it's not. I mean,
yeah.
But yeah, the thing of that lesbian bar scene is that they're all Susan Bright's friends that she got that to sense. Like to be extras in the scene. So they're all just lesbian extras in the lesbian bar. So yeah, that's why that scene looks so normal and so real. I mean. I don't want to talk about lesbian sex scene too much, but also it's like really well shot. Like the one thing, the camera, all that. It's really, I mean, you feel what's going on, which is like kind of the point. Like it's
right.
I feel like there's a lot of talk about like no sex scenes in movies. They don't help the plot, blah blah blah. But this is like a clear indicator, like a good, like a sex scene in a movie should just like. I mean, there's so much how can I say relationship dynamic that can be shown.
I mean, I'll say this
in
this subgenre of movies that doesn't really exist now. It exists. It's mainly on TV, and it's on like weird Netflix movies that you and I don't watch.
Yes.
It's squarely in a place where we are not in. But in these kinds of movies, sex scenes are somewhat important. I don't know if you've seen Body Heat, but that's another movie where like you really need to believe that William Hurt. You really need to believe that William Hurt and the actress's name I'm forgetting. You really need to believe that these two would do some of the things that they do in that film, not to spoil it for those who haven't seen it. You really need to believe the things that they're going to do.
I mean, if we're talking lesbian thrillers, Handmaiden is like a recent example of that.
Yes.
Where like a lot of that stuff is, I don't know, it's discussable like to the extent that it goes, but also it's like it's all done with a purpose very clearly.
And the purpose is very like you understand the extent that things go to in this movie later on. So like I think this scene is it's exactly as forward moving as it should be. And again, like I think to what you were saying kind of at the start there, it is part of their performances, and that's what's interesting to it or interesting about it for me is that a lot of their performances and a lot of their character actually comes through in this scene. And I, yeah. So, and then after that, we get, do we get like their first sort of major conversation where they're talking about their life almost immediately? Like they kind of, we get to know more about them after.
Yeah. It's like they're so weird. They talk about how they're so different. They have nothing really in common. She's like with Caesar. They've been together for 5 years. That's why Violet tells Corky that he's a money launderer. Corky talks a little bit about like where that she's been to jail, but not, we never learn what for. They have this tattoo scene, the scene where they talk about her tattoo, which is like the clearly the most fake tattoo because it's like so, it looks so new.
It looks like a
Hidden Yacht tattoo that was done the day before.
Yes, yeah, it feels like you can see like things flecking off if you really look closely. That's not even the most interesting tattoo for me is the one on her hand, which I couldn't find anything about. I was like, is that like a common tattoo? But it doesn't. Maybe it's just a very inside thing, or maybe it's her real tattoo that. Has meaning for her.
I mean, there's so much talk of hands early in the movie. Maybe it's just to draw more attention to them. Because it's like, Violet is like, I'm sure you're good with your hands. And they talk about the truck, and she has like, I'm sure you drive a 20-year-old truck. And she's like, actually, it's a 60-something, so it's 30 years old. which is very funny. And like, when she goes to take the earring out of the pipe, there's a very big zoom on the hands, like slowly turning the stuff. It's really, I mean, it's so there, like the stuff with the sex scene that I mentioned before that they cut off is, I think there was too much hand moving in it that you could see.
I don't know. So my brain immediately goes to, I'm sure some of it was the studio. I imagine that's also the MPAA, which I'm sure I've talked about on here before, how they have certain biases, and the MPAA does not like, they don't like suggestions of enjoyment in sex scenes of any kind. They're very anti that. But they are particularly not fans of anyone going down on a woman or stimulating a woman in any way. Not their favorite thing. So they've been very stringent about that in past movies. So that's where my brain goes to, is I imagine they were not fans of this movie in 1996, and they gave strong notes, which they're technically not allowed to do, but they do anyway, where they will, behind the scenes, tell directors, you need to cut this, this, and this in order to get a R rating. And I imagine this movie was probably on the edge, because I think it was an R here, but I imagine it was on the edge of NC-17 just for being a movie about this subject matter in 1996. Just guessing. because that's where things were at the time. That makes sense with the, fun censorship. doesn't exist now. No, not ever. Where were we on
then we get the torture scene. Like, we kind of get what's going on with Caesar. So there's this guy Shelley who stole little amounts from the mob. While I think he's supposed to be another launderer, or something to that extent. I mean, I don't know. He's been skimming money. He stole $2 million. They caught him. They're beating the shit out of him. They cut off his finger. You get Violet. That's like, you get a reaction shots of Violet. She's kind of hears it. And she, it really makes her angry, and also drives Caesar to punch. So Johnny is the guy doing the torture. He is, we learn Gino is the boss of the family, and he's Gino's son. So he is abusively torturing this man, and Caesar punches him in the face. I mean, after that, you get Violet telling Corky what's like, oh, that they caught this guy with all that money and all the violence, and she wants to get out. She wants to get out, and Corky comes up with like with the plan of how to steal the money.
And this is where the double indemnity stuff that I was talking about really comes in. And you even have Corky like addressing it, being like, how do I know that you're not going to betray me immediately? Which is, I like moments like that, especially in these 90s movies where they don't beat it over the head. It's just this character we're shown is like very competent, but not without flaw. And it comes through in Gershon's performance. And I really like the addressing of that and the way that it's handled. And yeah, we get like this sort of tension of who's playing who, or is she playing her? And yeah, I really
it's like the way that plays. There's like the big question of like, okay, can they trust each other? Is it like, is their relationship they have real, or is it just a way for them to get money, or is it are they going to betray each other if the opportunity comes, because just to save their selves? There's that big there's a lot of build up on that tension. The thing that does happen that leads to the punch is that Johnny shoots Shelly in the face, kills him, blood goes everywhere. Caesar, that's what made Caesar pissed, and he punches Johnny in the face. But yeah, then the money is full of blood, so you get the scene where Caesar brings back a bag of money full of blood, and then and then literally launders the money, where he washes the money and hangs it up, then irons it, then counts it, and it's like a scene that goes on through the night that Violet is kind of recounting, where they both didn't sleep. He's like a very obsessive man with his little tics, and it's like this is a very clear example of that. And he's so angry at Johnny.
There's like this, like, again, there's like a real simmering tension with him that kind of sets up what's going to happen later. And you really get that through his performance, just the way that he like counts the bills and handles all this stuff. And then we get sort of, we get the plan really starting to come together after that, as the two of them talk, and it kind of goes pretty fast. It's like, oh, we're gonna do this now,
you just do, and it's like, and then it, the rest of this movie goes on really slowly. So the plan is, Corky is gonna switch the money out of the case because she has amazing hands, so she can lockpick the case, and she can lockpick the door. Johnny has Caesar has this Glenlivet Scotch for Gino. That's the alcohol Gino drinks. Violet is gonna drop it on purpose, go out to buy another bottle, and while she's gone, Caesar's in the shower, she goes get another bottle, Corky goes in, switches the money, and when she comes back, she's gonna tell Caesar that she saw Johnny in the car in front. Caesar checks the money, the money's gone, and assume Johnny has taken it. In the plan, like, because he's lost the money and he knows Johnny and Gino are coming, they assume he's going to just run away. But this is where the plan doesn't work anymore, because he doesn't. He instead confronts... I mean, he has this like half-big plan of like kind of confronting Johnny and seeing if he's going to crack. And if he does, and then he doesn't, and then he makes the split-second decision of like pulling out a gun and then shooting everyone in the face.
Yeah. Yes. Again, the patience that I mentioned earlier. And it's it's really just a thrilling scene. It's just like slowly building up. You see him like thinking through as he goes along, and it's just like, oh, what's he gonna do? And then he murders everybody in the room, basically. And it's really good. I quite enjoyed it. And I wouldn't say he's scene chewing in this sequence, but he's doing a lot. And it's all extremely fun to watch. Again, I can see why you bring him over for your Matrix and you make him like one of the primary villains of the movie, or secondary villains, I guess. Because a lot of that Cypher betrayal stuff energy is here in a very different way. And it's just, yeah. And then you go along for the rest of the movie with him. And he's not, because of what we've said about the character and because of what they've told us about him, like, you get the sense that he could do anything in any moment. But he's not so chaotic and random that his choices seem out of nowhere. It's a very good setup. All of this is done really well. And these characters, again, they can do anything and they're capable of anything, but their choices all make complete sense. Unless there was something that snagged for you that I'm forgetting. But like, I feel like every character choice from here on out makes sense. And I just really enjoyed that like he's completely consistent. Corky's consistent. Yeah, it's just really well done.
I mean, yeah, I think the character work. Stuff. Yeah, I think what's really great is the character work and the performances are really solid, and all that really balances well. But I think a lot of the Caesar stuff is some of the best character work, like you said, because he's like what he does feels logical, but it's like the whole first part of the movie is always like trying to contain himself. And the thing I said earlier, when Gino and Johnny finally show up, it's very clear. It's like, this is when you get the stuff of him, like, okay, he's not part of the family in those moments. Gino asked him to sit on one side and Johnny to sit on the other side, and says, okay, Caesar, are you, you should respect Johnny more. He's my son. He is going to be head of the family. And then Johnny, don't be such an asshole, basically. But there's the line of like, okay, this is the respect. And then when he pulls the gun and Gino is like the most, speaking of people being the most, this is the most like, I want to be the Godfather man ever, like a guy that loves the Godfather, and it's like, yeah, this I can't be that guy. Just give me the gun.
Yes.
And Caesar just blows up, shoots him, shoots the other guy, blood everywhere. And it's like, what do we do now?
Yes.
It's really good. The shooting scene is like all slow motion, like time slows down to a crawl. It's like all through his point of view. And it's, I think one of, there's not a lot of gunshots in this movie, but this scene is like, oh yeah, a lot of the slow-mo stuff, a lot of the slow-mo shooting is in there that they do in later movies as well.
Yeah. And the use of music here is it's not a lot of big music, but like it's all, I would say, perfect for the sequence. And I think like the music here is really good. It sets the tone perfectly. Very good. And the tension that is in this scene, it's just like it keeps on getting kind of repeated. And it's like building on top of itself. Like it's like another sequence where we're like building a thing on top of it, and it just keeps on going like that. And I think the way that that's done is really good, because you have plots on top of plots, and like the main plot in the background, and like, is he gonna find out and all that, and like the, yeah, and it's just this building tension that comes to the end. But you have them, you have like a almost like a rope sequence here where it's like you're almost on Caesar's side for a few minutes of him like trying to cover it up. And again, like he's a character who's very much meant to be the antagonist, but I think that they do a really good job of like making you kind of like go with this and like, okay, well, in order for the other two characters to get out of this, we kind of need Caesar to make it to a certain point. I mean, and I think that that's handled really well. Yeah.
I mean, the thing that really happens is that, I mean, during all of all those scenes, like, Corky's out, right? She's in the apartment next door. We see some of her, we get some shots of her, like, as stuff is happening, but she's kind of like, doesn't do much. She's just waiting with the money. Violet is the one in the room, and it's so interesting to see how she reacts to everything, because she's the one that was really wrong. She like completely misjudged Caesar, right? Yeah. She's been living with him for 5 years, but the appearance he gave to her of himself, which wasn't totally him, is what she thought he really was. And then seeing her like kind of panic every time she makes a decision that's not part of the plan, and he makes them again and again and pulls her, and she's so good in those moments, trying to regain like every small inch of control whenever she can, because she's completely lost at this point, and she's by herself, right? She gets a second. She calls Corky. That first call to tell her, oh, he's not gonna run, and Corky is just like, let's wait and see, and she is like, okay, she's again all by herself. She has such a good. She has such a good screen presence in this moment. Such a good, like, panicked calmness, like, portraying both at the same time. It's she does that really, really well. Like, the interiority and, like, the panicking character trying to act as calm as can be. And, I mean, her voice is so good at that, because she has such a soft voice, and she makes it go even softer at times when she's trying to, I don't know, she's trying to take control by appearing her most meek self. It's all really good.
And then we get
they deal with, I mean, he cleans the apartment, put his body in the bathtub, moves all the furniture around, and because the cops are coming, and those, and the cops that come are the most like goofy movie cops of all time.
They are. So I think this is my equivalent of you saying, just don't put the phone back on the hook. Like these. These cops are a little bit ridiculous.
Yeah, like one goes in the bathroom and just pisses next to the bathtub full of bodies that's dripping blood on the floor. The other just like walks on the carpet and you see his boot like go in, like gets into like the slush of the blood. The blood comes out of the carpet on his boot and he doesn't look down. He never looks down to see if he has blood that's using blood stands behind him. They do this whole routine where they put on TV really loud. So that when they walk into the building, they like kind of look at each other like, oh, I guess this is what's going on.
Right.
This always happened to us on Friday nights or whatever. And then Caesar acts as if he has a hearing aid that he doesn't have at the time. So they're all screaming at each other. It's really funny.
Yes, they're screaming over Dawn of the Dead. Which is just, that it is almost, the comparison I would make is like, it's almost Simpsons level of like when they would do like a parody of like a thriller. And it's that exact same level of like, these characters are a little bit ridiculous, but I still found it quite enjoyable. I thought one of the cops was a longtime SNL cast member. But he's not, I guess he just, but he gave me that vibe for a second. I can't remember the actor's name. Then the cops leave and do they come back at some point? I don't remember if they come back.
No, the cops don't come back. This is when like Caesar is like full on, where's the money? Goes to the car, it's not in the car.
Yes.
Goes to the apartment, trashes the apartment completely. And this is where he calls Mickey and he's trying to like make this plan where he calls Mickey, tells him the monies and tells him that he has the money still, but they never make it. They made it. Gino and Johnny, they never got there. Mickey is like, okay, we're on your way, go back to your apartment. And this is when he's like kind of arranging the place even more, and Violet calls Corky. You get the shot that you mentioned of the of the telephone cable, and then they have this moment where Violet, the classic movie moment, like, oh, there's something I want to tell you. I already know. You don't need to. We're going to do this. Like, clearly the I love you moment. And, and Caesar just hears her hears her hang up the phone. And he's like, redials, hears the phone through the wall once. And then he's like, oh, it's her. Corky comes running in with the gun. She put during the time she hid the money in the white paint. And she breaks in to try to help Violet. But Caesar just knocks her out. And to the next 30 minutes of this movie, she gets knocked out maybe four more times.
Yeah, and then we kind of go back to the beginning, because it should be said there has been flashback thing going on. It's a little bit out of order. It's very like classic and like commonplace now, this structure. So it's very easy to like overlook it, but it is there. Like there's a
Forgot about that.
Probably wondering how I got into this type of thing, but it's not even that. It's much better than you're wondering how I got into this. She's like repeating lines, and then we're going back to when those lines were said. We're back to where the movie was at the very, very beginning. And then it sort of again begins to unfold from there. We're cutting back to her like slowly waking up, and constantly she's V is going to see her and all this stuff, and they're having like negotiations about, you know, whether or not he's going to kill her, or how, and stuff like that. And then we get him going into the shower at some point, and they start to talk. Am I, or did I skip over anything? Because At some point, he is naked and Mickey shows up. And that is another sequence that is extremely thrilling. But I'm trying to think if there's anything really important we need to.
He knocks Corky out. She's in. Yeah. I mean, they have the scene where they wake up and he's like,
"Yeah,
you did this. Where's the money?" And then she's like, "What if he? What if she lied? What if I lied?" I mean, she threatens. He threatens to cut off Violet's finger, so that Corky tells him where the money is, and she tells him, he. But this is when Mickey shows up. So they go in the bathroom and he comes out like as if he had come out of a shower, tells them, oh yeah, Violet's in the bathroom too. Because I think he brought Violet with him to check if the money was there. I think that's what happens.
Yes.
Anyway, there's a lot happening there. But the Mickey scene is very tense, very good. Where Violet calls him using Gino's cell phone that's in or Johnny, one of those dead guys' cell phone. So she calls the house and tells him act as if you're talking to Gino, and he was like, oh, Gino is at the hospital, this is what's going on, you should go there. They're all safe, but they're waiting to get released. And all this happening while, like the phone call happens when Mickey is like about to open the case because he can lockpick it. Like he got him lockpick the door, and he's about to lockpick the case, and it's like, oh, there's a call, so they leave. And this is when, like, I think this is when the chase happened, where, like, Violet runs out of the apartment. He's after her. Corky wakes up. She, like, kind of manages to get up and get, like, gets untied. There's this, like, little Scooby-Doo chase scene down the stairs where Violet like walks all the way down and takes the elevator up, and he's exhausted by the end. He walks down and like doesn't walk. It's like, oh fuck, I have to go up. I think they both try to get him at this point. No, Violet goes for a gun. Corky tries to get him with her like with one of her tools. He's about to kill her. Violet walks in. She has the gun. She's like, he's like, oh, I'm not, you'll never shoot me. You would have shot me already before. I know you. And Violet's like, you don't know shit. And then just, shoots him, kills him. He falls red blood into the white paint. The moment we're kind of all expecting, as soon as the white paint falls on the ground, I feel like it's pretty clear what they're gonna do here. Amazing shot, though. Still really good. And then Mickey. And then you get to just like an epilogue where like Mickey's back. She believes whatever Violet told her. He offered her to like go to be with him instead of Caesar. She's like, oh, I'm trying to get out of this life. I'm sorry. Gives him a kiss, even like a full on femme fatale manipulation. Really good last moment. And then she goes into the Corky's brand new red truck. It's very goofy. It's very like kind of goofy looking, like how red it is.
It's notable. It's worth noting, but it's like, it's like, it's the end of the movie. It's like, oh yeah, cool red car. And
I don't literally know, drive off in the sunset. They have this little moment where it's like, you know, what's the difference between us? Nothing. And then they drive off and movie ends. Yeah. Perfect.
I couldn't find a way to improve on it. Like, again, like, I like the way that this like plays with the audience, and you're like, and I think up until this moment, you're like, okay, but she's going to be like an FBI informant or something. But no, it's like, no, they just have the happy ending. I think it's an earned happy ending. She has her moment where she's like, you don't know shit, which perfect line, perfect way to end it for that character. She's been so, like you mentioned, meek and like accommodating throughout the entire movie, even to Corky, that when she like really like gives it back and takes him out, like, yeah, it's just an incredibly satisfying moment for that character. Yeah, I loved it. Good, this was a good pick. I think I picked this, and I'm proud of myself.
Yeah, this was a really good movie, really fun, highly, highly watchable. Compared to some of the stuff we watched recently, this is just a like really fun crime thriller. Crime thriller / erotic thriller.
Chicago crime thriller, which is almost its own subgenre that I am deeply in love with. So that was nice. And yeah, it's just I don't really have much else to say about the movie. Like it's not a lot. I'm sure there are like there's some deeper readings that can be done, but like yeah, it's just a really fun movie. And like you said, I highly recommend this to anyone that wants like a 90s thriller that they haven't seen. I do want to point out this movie, they have in like interviews, I guess, and in commentary said that Billy Wilder was a big influence, which makes sense. Like I said, it feels like Double Indemnity for like the first half of the movie, and it really has that same vibe. I feel like you could, if you did remove some of the sexual stuff, this could be like a 1940s or pre-code 1930s thriller, noir movie. A lot of it is like very old school, but again, like we said at the beginning, it's just so competently done that it doesn't feel old or trite. It's incredibly watchable. So
it just really adapts that stuff in a very modern way, modern setting. Like all the characters feel very, very modern. And a lot of it is like in the performances. A lot of it is like the settings. I mean, it's all just a really, really good movie. I mean, there's not that much deeper stuff to say, I feel, about it. I mean, I guess it does play a little different now, after the directors came out as women. So it's it plays a bit differently in that way, especially when it's like such a movie about like I don't know, kind of the boxes we put people in, and like like a lot of the relationship between Caesar and Violet is so much about like him. He would never, I mean, when he sees Corky, he immediately knows she's a lesbian, but he has no like not even for a second he thinks that Violet would be into her over him, or would do anything with a woman, because she's such a feminine woman. I mean, just the way like her voice, like the snuffness of her voice changes when she's talking to him and trying to reassure him, or when she's talking with Corky by himself, it's like more normal tone of voice, her more natural tone of voice, I would say.
Oh, that does bring up one line that I really liked from the earlier on in the movie, and it kind of goes to what we're talking about with like the, is she playing Corky, which is her line, that wasn't sex, it was work.
Yes.
I really like the handling of that. And that feels, especially for 1996, even more than like the queer stuff in this movie, like a very ahead of its time. Swerfs are a big problem in the world, just in general. And that feels very forward thinking to me. So I just wanted to point that out. And the way that they approach that moment is used both as like, again, like to increase the tension, but like it does feel overall sympathetic to that as like a viable way of living your life, and like this is what you have to do in order to like gain power and control over your life. And the movie, like, it plays that really well. So yeah, I just wanted to. Yeah,
I mean, yeah. When she's about to kill him, and he goes like, "Oh, I did everything for you. What would you be without me? I give you this apartment and this life and this money," and it's like clearly, it's all his. He didn't give her anything. You know what I mean? It's like, right. Okay, she's kind of cosplaying at this guy's wife more or less, but she's like, he could throw her on the street and she'd be back to being nothing. So everything she does with him is like work to keep that center of life. And then her response, which is like, what did she did what you couldn't do. I mean, she did everything you couldn't.
Yeah, and that even connects to this one exchange when Mickey comes in, where he's like, "Oh, you know, Vi, she made me move the apartment around," and like they've already established earlier on in the movie, he's the one who is super obsessive about cleaning and keeping everything nice and tidy, you know. And she says this line about, you know, we had to rearrange the entire apartment before Gino came over this one time, and like I the way in which she is like almost another painting for him. Like she might as well be just like a statue that he has in the middle of his living room. it's a very interesting thing to do for this character. And the dynamic of that is very, interesting. I think we've done it. I think we did all of it. Unless you had a final thought, because I think
I think that's about it. We did we talked about everything. I want to do more. I want to do the rest of the Wachowski's filmography. I feel like.
Okay. If we have to, this is where I get like, I don't know.
I'm just really. I feel like. Okay, I really like Speed Racer. It's really fun.
Speed Racer's good.
I feel like I haven't watched Call Atlas, and I'm just curious of doing that and talking about it. I feel like it's one that there would be stuff to talk about in both good and bad ways.
The thing that I would be with you on is I wouldn't mind going back and watching Sensei, just because it hasn't left the public consciousness, and people aren't talking about it less now. So like I could go with you on that. Jupiter Ascending is gonna be hard.
No. I don't think we ever do. I kind of want to watch that one, but I because I haven't. But I don't think we need to do more. And if we do that, there's a friend of ours who would kill us both if they're not allowed to be on this show.
Yes. To defend it vociferously.
Maybe we'll go back to the Wachowski someday. Maybe not. But this might be. I need a few months, but this might be their best movie or one of their best movies. I don't know. I feel like we've talked about the Matrix movies, and I feel like we both. The first one is such a masterpiece, and then the second one we both kind of, I mean, I really love, I think we both kind of like at least, and then the third one is like, what's going on there?
A lot of interesting ideas, and we discuss what ideas are interesting in those podcasts, but if you don't want to listen to all the details, like, there's interesting stuff in them, but they could be tighter, they could be better.
Yes.
But I think the thing with that first Matrix is it's in that area of a movie that's been such a seismic impact on pop culture that it's hard to talk about it outside of that context. And it's hard to like truly judge it. It happens to be one of the more entertaining movies ever made, which is why I think we were able to actually talk about it when we did those episodes. It's not one of those where it becomes boring to talk about. Like, there's new things and interesting things to get caught up on. It has that same, you know, like trying to talk about A New Hope, for example. I don't think I could do an hour on New Hope with you. You could do an hour on New Hope probably with somebody who's more of a Star Wars person than I am.
Yes.
But I'm just not there.
I feel like it's movies like that I kind of just love and don't feel the need to talk about them.
This has become a very our thoughts on how we do this, but I don't mind it.
I think you're right. Anyway, this great movie, really must watch Wachowski movies. If you haven't watched it, you should. I think I'm with you on, I'd definitely watch that in a theater if I got the chance.
Yes, absolutely.
I feel like I would do that with most of their movies, to be honest.
Sure.
I think we can wrap here and do some plugs. You can follow me on Twitter, Instagram, and Letterboxd. I'm at Isir everywhere. And that's about it.
Yeah. And then go through Eric's follows and find me if you want to. If you don't, that's fine too. Or just bookmark me and comment when I'm watching an old Italian movie, as I've said in a previous episode, and ask if I'm okay.
If you see me watch 7 Jean-Luc Godard movies in a row, just look past it, just move on.
Yes. But other than that, my other show, Phantom Zone, it's back. I think it's back. So go listen to it, or be like Eric and listen to all of them at once in like a couple days span, and then message me about it.
Yeah, just listen to a December episode that Arlen probably barely remembers and ask his opinion on stuff that he actually.
And I'm like, you're talking to a different person now. Life has changed so much. So go do that. And that's the show. Bye.
Hang up the phone. Please hang up the phone.
Disconnect the phone. Take it off.
Yes. And that's what I was trying to say. Disconnect the phone, or just don't hang it up. Just leave the line open so that he can't call you.
You just touch the hang up button. You know what I'm talking about. You just press that and then you leave it off the line. It's very simple. Very, very simple.